Chapter 25, The Fixer, 1995. An actor named Raymond Cruz, who I met in Venice, took me to meet his agency. He thought I needed better representation. I don't think Raymond's agent saw much in me, but to keep Raymond happy, they kicked me off to a junior agent named Gloria Hinojosa, who just started working at the company. Gloria was funny, she was cool, and most important, she was a hustler. As soon as I signed with Gloria, my career took off. The first gig Gloria got me was Baywatch, in which, surprise, I played a Harley-riding ex-convict who was too much of a dick to let his kid take part in a program for kids from the barrio. It was fun, everyone was cool, and I got paid to hang out at the beach a few blocks from my apartment. Work was fast, but not diverse. I got offered a part in a prison flick called Last Light with Kiefer Sutherland and Forrest Whitaker. It was Kiefer's directorial debut. I was cast again as, surprise, an inmate. My official character name was Second Inmate. Privately, I thought, Second Inmate, damn, I'm heading backwards. Early in production, Kiefer had brought a friend into the project who ended up being out of control. Kiefer may have thought the guy's wildness could make him a convincing inmate, but on movie sets, unpredictability just causes a big fucking headache. Whenever the AD would say rolling for the film to begin, the guy would start belting out Rolling on the River loudly and aggressively. By the time I arrived, the guy was gone. When Kiefer figured out he was too volatile, he had to have security escort him off the set. That's when things took a funkier turn. I could tell something was eating at Kiefer. He was struggling. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Nothing." But a week later, it was clear it wasn't just nothing. Kiefer called me from New York and told me he was worried about this guy, that after he fired him from the movie, the guy threatened his family and his kids. I was an actor, but I was also seen as a bit of a fixer. I had a reputation for knowing how things operated on the streets. If people had a problem that they didn't think had a legal solution, they'd hit me up for advice and help. I told Kiefer not to worry about it. I found out who the guy was, and George and I spoke to him. The man was upset because Kiefer had promised him after so many days of work he could get a Screen Actors Guild card, and that's why he was hounding him. I tried to be diplomatic and said, maybe the card didn't work out on this one. But if you don't cut it out, someone might put an M80 in your ass and light it. That seemed to do the trick. The next day he sent flowers and an apology to Kiefer's wife. What I learned about Hollywood is that if I help someone with a problem, they either become my best friend or they grew distant from me. Kiefer was legitimately grateful. As for the others, maybe they felt that by asking for help, they'd reveal a weakness. This was a pattern that went down a few times in my film career. I understood why people came to me. I was considered a legit hard man, not just a dude who played one. But the dynamic wasn't always comfortable. It was the same shit I faced on American Me all over again. I think, did you want to hire me because I'm an actor or because I'm an ex-convict? Whatever my private concern about how I was perceived, it was clear Hollywood casting agent saw me as a baddie. The following year, I was hired to play Johnny 23 in Con Air, a serial rapist who is part of a group of convicts planning to escape by stealing a prison transport plane. Conair was a macho fest from the start, both the film and the production. Nothing was said or done that didn't become a dick-measuring contest. Benny the Jet Yukitas, a world karate and kickboxing legend, was hanging around the set because he was training John Cusack at the time. Guys were always pulling pranks during production. One time it was raining and someone pulled on a tarp we were sitting under. Water got on me and I jumped up in a flash and said, "What the fuck?" Benny saw how pissed I was and pulled me away. These dudes don't get what our kind of anger is, Danny. I got into some conversations with dudes on the job that always funneled to the same conclusion. How do you think I would do in prison? It's a strange, almost universal fascination of men. They don't get how messed up a question it is. First of all, anyone who would ever ask it is probably not going to do well in prison because you already know what they're scared of, being molested. How would they do? Maybe if, like a lot of kids who were in juvie with me, they hit someone in the head with a bat or a chunk of concrete or stab them. They start to build a rep that might shield them from some of the violence, but you had to commit violence to avoid violence. I knew what the actors were getting at, but it was foolish. People have this fantasy about holding your mud, that if you stood up the first time anyone challenged you, you'd get to do unmolested time. It's bullshit. I knew a white kid that went in, got shit from Mexicans, and fucked two of them up in his cell. The dude was bad. Two nights later, they found him in his cell with his beanie on and his throat slit from ear to ear. A pool of his blood on the tier was what alerted the guards. He did what he was supposed to do, what people on the outside think you have to do for people to leave you alone. And the two Mexicans went to his cell and took his life. If you go in, you have to go with your race, put in the work, and only then will you have some protection. Even then, you still have to fear your own guys. Prison are breeding grounds for paranoia and insanity. All it takes is for one dude in your clique to say something, be it because of jealousy or suspicion. Once a rumor is whispered, true or not, you're already on the defensive, and a lot of times the penalty is death. You've got to be really careful if you get involved with stupid shit like drugs and gambling. Anything that could cause you to be in debt, because if you cause problems, you get regulated by your own crew. Or you pay protection and walk around the yard like a bitch. For people who are recognizable and known, when they go in, their only option is to pay for protection. I've seen pictures of famous guys in the joint with their posse, but they are paying them one way or another. Before my dad married, when I was living at my grandparents' house, I did everything with my aunts and cousins. The house had four bedrooms. Grandma and Grandpa slept in one. My dad and uncles, Art, Rudy, Fred, and Gilbert, shared a room. My aunt Carmen and her husband, Manuel, shared another, and the other eight of us. My aunts, Margaret, Raina, Lobby, Carmen's four daughters, Mary Carmen, Coke, and Tony, the twins, and Salita, and I slept in a room with four beds at the end of a long hallway. I was the youngest, and if you see pictures of me when I'm little, I'm always with girls. Four here, five there, nine there. We did everything separately from the men, even meals. That's why I didn't know I could be standing up until my Uncle Gilbert told me. We played make-believe and dress-up and played with dolls. And our dog, Blackie, we screamed, we laughed. What I remembered most and missed in the male-dominant environment I was in later was that there was no competition. If one of the girls could throw a rock harder, it was cool. No one questioned it. No one contested it. Con Air, on the other hand, was like the streets and prison, where guys competed over who could hit harder, pee longer, do more push-ups, pull more chicks, even spit farther. Men were playing the same dangerous games in the safety of a movie set. Nick Cage was cool as hell, though. As testosterone-driven as the set was, I made more friends on Con Air than almost any movie I'd ever been in. John Malkovich, Steve Buscemi, Ving Rhames, Jesse Borrego, Dave Chappelle, and my homie, Emilio Rivera. Emilio really impressed me. He reminded me a lot of me, the way he came up, how he handled himself on the set. And for the record, John Cusack is a legit kickboxing badass. Con Air ended up being a good flick, but sometimes playing sick dudes like Johnny 23 gets to me. I've seen too many of them in real life. As far as working with big Hollywood stars, my next film took everything to the next level. Heat put me in with the big boys. I'd met the director, Michael Mann, a few years earlier when I was cast in Drug Wars, the Camarena Story, a miniseries about Enrique Kiki Camarena, an undercover DEA agent who was tortured and killed by the cartel in Guadalajara. I got to talking to Michael about doing a scene he complimented me on. I'll never forget, he had a reputation of being tough as nails, but he came up to my trailer after a scene where I verbally attacked Treat Williams. Michael had told me to go after Treat hard on one take, and I did, and I think it took everyone by surprise. Michael knocked on my door, and I could have sworn I was getting fired. Instead, he said, "Danny, that was an Emmy-worthy performance." I didn't know what an Emmy was. I thought if scaring people is Emmy-worthy, I should have won a ton of them. I wasn't even hired to be an actor. Eddie Bunker and I were brought on as armed robber consultants when production started. The first time Michael Mann saw me, he called me Gilbert. Mann had shot the Jericho Mile 10 years earlier in Folsom, but I never put it together that he was there at the same time my Uncle Gilbert was. I told Michael Mann that I was Danny, Gilbert's nephew. At first he looked confused, like he thought I was mistaken or he was seeing a ghost. Then a look of recognition washed over his face. He said, "Oh yeah, Danny, we did the Camarena miniseries together." Michael said Gilbert had made it possible to complete filming on the Jericho Mile. The film in any working prison production needs the cooperation of the inmates. The black and whites were on board, but the Mexicans weren't. Gilbert and some other Mexican shot callers handled the negotiations and got the Mexicans to okay the flick. Gilbert even snagged himself SAG union days. I told Michael that Gilbert had passed. He was genuinely moved. After we'd worked all that out, Michael said, "Danny, there's a part in this movie I think you'd be right for." At the time, the character's name was Vince or something similar. I don't think he was even Mexican. The script went through two revisions while I read for the part, but on my third try, Michael just handed me the script and said, "Danny, you have the part. I'm sorry, but I can't call this character anything but Gilbert Trejo." He said it almost apologetically, but to me, it was the greatest honor. Heat is a heist movie, one of the greatest, most thrilling heist movies of all times. It starred Val Kilmer, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, John Voight, Tom Sizemore, Amy Brennerman, and Ashley Judd. On top of my part being named after Gilbert Trejo, John Voight's character was based on Eddie Bunker. The first day John Voight went to the set, he brought a picture of Eddie into the makeup trailer and said, "Make me look like this." The end result was so good, every time I watch the movie, I think of Eddie. Heat was the first time I felt in complete awe of people I was working with. It was like I'd been painting houses for a long time and suddenly found myself in a Van Gogh. De Niro is a living legend, but he was so patient with me and taught me so much during our scenes. He's the kind of actor who puts the script down and works out the moment. It isn't the words with Robert De Niro. It's the space around them. When we were blocking out my death scene, he said, "Danny, how do you think we should play this?" I said, "Bob, what do you think?" He said, "I think you're already dead and just holding on long enough to ask me to kill you." That angle made it so powerful. In the scene, I ask, "Where's my Anna?" And he says, "Dead." I moaned in a combination of pain and hope leaving my character's body. When man called cut on the scene, Bobby said, "Great job, Danny," and helped me off the floor. When we were working, I watched Robert on set. He was always kind, but conserved his energy for when it mattered. A shooting day can sometimes be 17 hours. It's a lot, and you have to give full energy every take. Watching De Niro, Kilmer, and Voight, I learned a lot about how they save it for when it matters. There's an unreality to movie sets that exists nowhere else in the world. There was a time, it's changing, when certain people, usually actors and directors, were allowed to get away with terrible behavior. I've seen actors say awful things to crew members, and you know that if it happened anywhere else, that grip or electrician would have fucked them up. But because it was on a set, they didn't want the production to grind to a halt or risk getting a bad reputation. I saw an actor once get in the face of a young wardrobe intern and make her cry. I said, "Lighten up." He stood as if to challenge me, and I said, "You better think about what you're doing." He knew I meant business. I called Eddie and told him what had happened. He said, "I get it, but before you kill him, you should reach into your wallet and tear up your SAG card, because you'll be killing the star of the movie." I told Eddie to pick me up. While I was waiting, someone from production came to me. This never happens, but they offered me double my pay if I would stay and keep this actor in line. Looking back, it was a small price to pay to protect their investment. Hollywood needs muscle, too. When Heat wrapped, I gave Michael Mann a photo of Gilbert in the pen that was never supposed to be taken. It was definitely not one for the feds. It was all the shot callers. As far as I know, Michael Mann has that picture of Gilbert hanging in his office to this day. After Heat came out on VHS, I watched it with Maeve Gilbert and Danielle. The kids were still little, and even though I was right there with them, it was still hard for them to watch. It was the first time they'd seen me die on screen. Gilbert was the one who managed to stay on the couch. Danielle and Maeve had to leave the room. I went to Danielle's room and gave her a hug. She held on to me like she wanted proof I was really there. My death scene in Heat felt real to her because she was so little. But it felt real to me, too. I was acting under my uncle's name, my son's name, dying with nothing left to live for. It was where my life had been headed and how it might have gone.